Chapter 2. Certainty, Religious and Scientific. From the day of his birth, on September 26, 1849, Ivan Petrovich Pavlov was expected to follow six generations of Pavlov men into service to the Eastern Orthodox Church. His father, Peter Dmitrievich Pavlov, was the much-respected priest of Ryazan's Nikolo-Vysokovskaya Church, a pillar of the community, who served as spiritual counselor to the local police and regiment, and supplemented his emoluments from clerical services with the income from his renowned fruit and berry garden. His mother, Varvara Ivanovna Pavlova, also from a priestly family, was an intelligent, extremely intense woman who, consigned deliberately by her parents to illiteracy, taught herself how to read. Peter Dmitrievich took pride in the peasant origins and physical strength of generations of Pavlov men, so he worried about the frailty and emotional volatility of his firstborn son. Endowed with a phenomenal memory, Ivan was passionate, willful, and thin-skinned, laughing, screaming, and arguing until the tears fell. He later recalled himself as a puny, sickly lad who was constantly at the center of terrible quarrels, could spit and swear and fight, and, indiscriminately pugnacious, frequently took a thrashing from bigger boys. Pavlov's father attributed this worrisome emotionality to Varvara Ivanovna's hereditary influence. After giving birth to her first three children, she had become especially explosive, subject to nervous disturbances and excruciating headaches that often culminated in screaming frenzies. Pavlov would later describe her lovingly to two biographers, but in ways that led them to characterize her as abnormally unbalanced. And his father constantly intoned that there is much of his mother in Ivan. Yet the Pavlov line, too, exhibited worrisome peculiarities. Peter Dmitrievich was a steady, disciplined, and unyielding patriarch. But Ivan's two paternal uncles were both defrocked after dramatic displays of what he later termed internal disorderliness, which in one uncle took the form of chronic drunkenness and brawling, and in the other, an apparently uncontrollable passion for strange, irreligious pranks. Pavlov's lifelong interest in the psyche, then, may well have originated from his experience with his own morbid, spontaneous paroxysms, his words, and with the emotional instability of family members. As a student and young professional in the 1870s and 1880s, he would several times be diagnosed with neurosismus and hysteria. As a laboratory chief from the 1890s through the 1930s, his explosive outbursts at coworkers were legendary. And even in his 70s, he wondered how such an unbalanced choleric as he could become a successful scientist, a mystery that he finally resolved through conditional reflex experiments on dogs. The unity of mind and body was part of the Eastern Orthodox culture that Ivan imbibed at home, in his father's church, and for many months at a local monastery. At about age 8, he took a bad fall off a high fence onto a stone platform, breaking some bones, suffering for months from pleurisy and other complications, and becoming so weak that his younger brothers teased him about his frailty. Ivan's godfather, the father superior at nearby Troitsky Monastery, finally took him under his wing and subjected him to a strict routine that featured vigorous physical activity during the day and confinement to his room with a reading and writing assignment every night. Upon recovery, Ivan took with him the monk's gift of a favorite book, Krylov's Fables, which he kept on his writing table for the rest of his life. Pavlov left no record about the fear and helplessness he must have felt during the long, uncertain months after the accident, but would speak often about his rescue at the monastery as a turning point in his life. The monk's remedy for the broken boy became a tale and credo about the triumph of self-discipline, work, and regularity over the depredations of slučajnost, chance, uncertainty, a lesson about the unity of mind and body and the benefits of combining physical and mental labor. As a young man, he often honored those lessons in the breach. In later years, they became the foundations of his daily existence. Despite the atheism of his adult years, Pavlov retained powerful nostalgic memories about the spiritual comforts of religious life. He particularly enjoyed reminiscing about Easter. During the fast, food on the table was scanty, Lenten, the weather gloomy, the church melodies mournful. And then, suddenly, there began the bright rejoicing of Easter with its clear sunny days, with joyous, cheerful melodies, and with an abundance of tasty delicacies. Asked by a coworker in the 1910s about his attachment to the holiday, he alluded revealingly to an Eastern Orthodox custom that promised children certain protection from ill fortune if they could accomplish one task. I remember vividly how on Holy Thursday, Mother would bundle me and my brothers off to church, give us each a candle, and tell us that during the service we must light a candle and then carry it home. And we went and worried that the candle would go out. And these memories are so joyful that I sometimes go to church on Christmas and Easter. Seminarian in the 1860s. At age 15, he entered Rizan Seminary, where the culture featured that familiar emphasis on balance, self-discipline, mind-body integration, and the certainties of faith. Here, some 470 students received a classical ecclesiastical education that emphasized church doctrine and history while also preparing them in history, literature, foreign languages, and math. The natural sciences were represented by one course on physics and cosmography. Ivan's circle at seminary included his younger brothers, Dmitry and Peter, and two sons of the rural clergy, Nikolai Bistrov and Ivan Cheltsov, who rented corners in the Pavlov home. During their first years there, Ivan, Bistrov, and Cheltsov ranked at the very top of their class. Some courses explicitly confronted the heretical views that were becoming increasingly popular within the intelligentsia in the 1860s. Moral theology, for example, concerned the history and content of Christian moral doctrine, including the moral nature of man, his high dostoyevstvo, moral dignity and obligations and calling, contrasted the Christian and naturalistic views of virtue, and refuted claims that science contradicted Christian doctrine. Basic theology did battle against materialism, atheism, and pantheism. Here too, during the first half of 1867, Ivan received the only formal instruction of his life in logic and psychology. The young cleric, Nikolai Glebov, explained that human psychology is governed by the complex interplay of body and soul, the former responding passively to external material conditions, the latter acting independent of them. Glebov acknowledged that the digestive, circulatory, and nervous systems all influenced human thought and feelings, even contributing to differences in personality, but emphasized that the soul, a spiritual, independent, conscious, and free force, manifested itself in humans' higher, active self. Stimuli from the external world impress themselves upon our sensory organs, but only the activity of the soul, manifested in attention, representation, and memory, created mental images, ideas, and judgments. Ivan absorbed Glebov's perspective well enough to earn a grade of excellent in the course, but had by this time embraced a very different worldview under the influence of Russia's people of the 1860s, Shestidesyatniki. Encouraged by Tsar Alexander II's reforms, particularly his emancipation of the serfs, greater latitude for local government, and relaxation of censorship, these thinkers portrayed science as central to the formation of the new type of individual essential for the creation of a new, modernized Russia. Ivan's favorite essayist of the time, Dmitry Pisarev, argued that these thinking proletarians, or realists, steeped in insights, methodologies, and intellectual discipline of science, would sweep away the mystifying muddle of church and state superstition and lead the way to a productive, powerful, and just Russia. Students at seminary were expressly forbidden to read books of their own choosing, especially books with ideas contrary to morality and church doctrine. But in their hunger for precisely such works, Ivan and his friends awoke early to join other enthusiasts in front of Rizan's new public library. They eagerly devoured new translations of the vulgar materialists Karl Vogt, Jacob Moleschott, and Ludwig Buchner, lectures by French physiologist Claude Bernard, whom Pavlov later called the original inspiration of my physiological activity, G.H. Lewis's Physiology of the Common Life, Wilhelm Wundt's Lectures on the Human and Animal Mind, and Russian physiologist Ivan Sechenov's controversial Reflexes of the Brain, in which he argued that even noble thoughts and volitional acts could be explained as reflexive responses. The worldview that Pavlov absorbed from his circle's discussion of these readings would remain essentially unchanged throughout his life. The scientific method was identical whether one analyzed a rock, a plant, a frog, a human, or human society. True explanations were mechanistic in each case, since organisms, including humans, were complex machines. Science, free of empty philosophizing, was the only true path to plentiful production, social justice, and human progress, that is, to humans' rational control of their own destiny. His other favorite non-scientific author, alongside Pisarev, was Samuel Smiles, a leading British popularizer of bourgeois Victorian values, whose Self-Help and Lives of the Engineers emphasized the importance of character, honor, self-discipline, consistency, and purposeful hard work. By imposing their will on nature, Smiles's historic engineers promoted reliable, gradual social progress. The British author translated into secular language values that Ivan had imbibed from his religious milieu. Indeed, Smiles's title, Self-Help, was translated into Russian as samodeitelnost, the same term that Glebov employed to denote the active powers of the soul. For Pavlov, then, science offered a powerful, modern, secular alternative to religion, an all-encompassing worldview that promised certainty in addressing the big questions in life, replaced service to God with service to country and humankind, and provided a moral compass and purpose. The particularities gained nuance as he matured and professionalized, but the religious fervor and all-integrating nature of his faith and commitment to science never changed. Quitting seminary in fall of 1869, he announced that he would instead study science at St. Petersburg University. That decision led to a bitter confrontation with his father, heated arguments in which I went too far, and that ended in quite serious quarrels. After 1 year studying for the matriculation exams, he set off with Bistrov and Cheltsov for the sparkling center of Russian science. Science in St. Petersburg. The faculty at this time was in a brilliant state, Pavlov later recalled. We had a series of professors with enormous scientific authority and outstanding talent as lecturers. The science faculty was indeed dazzling. The lecturer to Pavlov's freshman class on inorganic chemistry was Dmitry Mendeleev, who had created his periodic table of the elements 1 year earlier as a teaching aid for this very course. Pavlov's second-year lecturer on organic chemistry would be another eminent scientist, Alexander Butlerov. Three other important scientists lectured on the biological sciences during his first year. Professor of zoology, Karl Kessler, an ichthyologist, had just been elected president of the St. Petersburg Society of Naturalists and was among Russia's many pre-Darwinian evolutionists. Another was professor of botany, Andrei Beketov, who was well on his way to the scientific, organizational, and pedagogical achievements that would earn him acclaim as the father of Russian botany. The first-year course on human anatomy was taught by the country's most eminent physiologist, Philip Osvianikov, a member of the elite Academy of Sciences, whose research was cited in Lewis's Physiology of Common Life, and lauded by Pisarev as an outstanding example of Russian scientific achievement. Yet it was adjunct assistant professor of physiology Ilya Sion who became Pavlov's mentor, initiating him into the pleasures of what his protege termed the mature mind. This dynamic young professor created an enormous impression upon all of us aspiring physiologists, Pavlov later recalled. We were simply astounded by his masterful, simple presentation of the most complex physiological questions and his truly artistic ability to perform experiments. Writing to Sion, decades after their work together, he reminisced warmly that, for me, your lectures in the special course at the university and work in your laboratory are among the best memories of my youth. Only 7 years older than Pavlov, Sion was already renowned for his scientific achievements, having collaborated in the 1860s with both Claude Bernard and Carl Ludwig on studies of the nervous system's role in the self-regulation of physiological processes. In one important contribution, he demonstrated the reflex action by which the depressor branch of the vagus nerve lowered blood pressure by dilating the vessels. In another, he collaborated with Bernard to discover nerves that accelerated cardiac activity. Trained and highly praised by Western Europe's leading physiologists, Sion was perfectly positioned for appointment to St. Petersburg University's expanding Department of Anatomy and Physiology. When Sechenov resigned his professorship at St. Petersburg's Medical Surgical Academy, the country's leading medical school and center of scientific medicine, later renamed the Military Medical Academy, he acquired that position as well. Sion taught Pavlov a physico-vivisectionist approach that combined Claude Bernard's basic view of physiology and the organism with perspectives and precision-oriented techniques associated with Carl Ludwig and German physiology. For Bernard and Sion, the physiologist ignored metaphysical questions about essences. There were neither materialists nor idealists in the lab, and sought to establish precise, consistent, and purposive regularities in organ systems, a level of organization that was high enough to capture the vital qualities that defined physiology's basic subject, but low enough to establish the determined relations essential to any science. As the science of life, physiology then sought the determined laws of such vital processes as circulation, respiration, and digestion. These processes had their own laws, which could neither violate nor be reduced to those of physics and chemistry. Sion emphasized the role of methodological developments that were transforming vivisection into an effective tool for experimentation, allowing physiologists to study in isolation the functions of individual organs. Pavlov's later term for this would be physiological surgery. Using his own two-volume guide to laboratory experimentation, he demonstrated how, by adapting technologies developed in physics, such as Ludwig's chymograph and Etienne Jules Marais' sphymograph and cardiograph, physiologists could observe and record experimental phenomena more accurately, and even describe their regularities in numerical terms. A talented vivisector, he also taught the ambidextrous Pavlov the surgical skills necessary to this style of physiology. By January 1874, Pavlov was hooked on research and petitioned the dean for an extra year on fellowship to continue it without the distraction of fourth-year coursework. Granted the extra year, though not the additional fellowship, he used it to collaborate with other students on three original research projects that extended Sion's investigation of the nervous regulation of organ systems. Two concerned the heart and circulatory system. The third earned the gold medal in a university competition to address the theme, suggested by Sion, on the nerves governing the work of the pancreatic gland. Pavlov's plans were now clear and exciting. After graduation, he would serve as Sion's lab assistant at the Medical Surgical Academy, while earning there the medical degree considered a prerequisite for a professorship in physiology. Soon, however, he was reeling from a most unlikely and traumatic wild episode, as he later put it. The linchpin of his plans, this most talented physiologist, Ilya Sion, was chased out of the academy. Sion's shocking demise resulted from the confluence of various factors in a perfect storm. A powerful faction at the Military Surgical Academy had always opposed his appointment. His provocative, politically conservative public lecture of January 1873 on the heart and the brain, in which he attacked nihilists who falsely viewed physiology as a materialist science, alienated much of the faculty and student body. Anti-Semitism, he was Russia's first Jewish professor, and his personal truculence set many people in all camps against him. The precipitating event arose from the mundane issue of grades. Although the academy's faculty and curriculum had been reformed in the spirit of scientific medicine, many students remained unconvinced that theoretical sciences, such as physiology, were directly relevant to medical practice. Nor, at this time, was there much evidence to the contrary. Traditionally, then, a student delegation would request that their teacher of a theoretical science forego an exam and give the entire class a passing grade. Sion, however, refused. The students ignored his warnings, and 130 of them failed his final exam in spring 1874. Encouraged by a bitter attack on Sion in the populist journal Fatherland Notes, student protesters showed up en masse at his first lecture of 1874, heckling him, pelting him with eggs and cucumbers, and demanding his dismissal. The conflict escalated into a general boycott of classes at the academy, and then, when security forces forcibly suppressed the protests, spread to Petersburg's other institutions of higher learning, igniting general student discontent and generating more fundamental demands. For example, an end to police surveillance on campus. The authorities finally suppressed the demonstrations, closed the schools, and arrested and expelled thousands of students. Rather than risk further disorder, they insisted that Sion take some time off. That leave was extended indefinitely, and in fall 1875, he formally resigned from both university and academy. Pavlov's adored mentor had been humiliated and his career destroyed, and Pavlov's own plans for an extended apprenticeship as Sion's assistant had evaporated. A few years later, his fiancée noticed that he never spoke about the incident, but clearly appreciated her sympathetic sarcasm about ignoramuses wishing to receive a medical degree for playing billiards. More than 40 years later, in a public address on the Russian mind, he commented bitterly about Russians' attitude toward freedom of speech. "Do we have this freedom? One must say no. I remember my student years. To say anything against the general mood was impossible. You were dragged down and all but labeled a spy." Crushed emotionally and crippled professionally by this unpredictable turn of events, he headed to medical school in pursuit of his now much less likely goal of a professorship in physiology. He would find other patrons, but never another mentor. For the next 15 very difficult years, Pavlov made his own way in the wilderness. He slogged unenthusiastically through medical school, 1875 through 79, while assuming various tasks in labs to make ends meet and continue his research. Through the intervention of a friend, in 1878, he became manager of the small, poorly equipped lab of Sergei Botkin, the Academy's eminent professor of medicine, physician to the royal family, and Russia's leading apostle of scientific medicine. With Botkin's support, he entered the Academy's Institute of Physicians, where he wrote his doctoral thesis on the centrifugal nerves of the heart, 1883, and the following year received a coveted fellowship to spend 2 years abroad in the labs of distinguished German physiologists Rudolf Heidenhain and Karl Ludwig. He returned to Russia, however, with bleak job prospects, and now married with a son, scratched together a precarious existence as a privat docent at the academy, a part-time instructor of medical paraprofessionals, and Botkin's lab manager. In 1888, and again in 1889, he failed in competitions with better-connected candidates for rare professorships in physiology at Tomsk and St. Petersburg universities. Money was so tight that the family was often compelled to live separately. For some months, Pavlov suffered from symptoms that convinced him he was dying of tabes, progressive degeneration of the nerves, but was much relieved by a physician's alternative diagnosis of hysteria. Science, Self, and Dostoevsky. Pavlov expressed his thoughts and feelings during these years about science, human psychology, and his own values and identity in his intimate correspondence with Serafima Karchevskaya, the religiously devout woman whom he married in 1881. He wooed her initially through a journal, Trapped, in which the centerpiece was an essay, the critical period in the life of a rational person, a clearly autobiographical meditation on his passage from the passions of the youthful enthusiast to the sober pleasures of the professional scientist. The great challenge of the critical period, Pavlov explained, was preserving the positive features of the youthful mind into adulthood. The youthful mind was excitable, passionate, and wide-ranging, engaged in issues from all possible sciences, philosophical questions about God, the soul, and so forth, about every fact of life. Yet, this light-hearted stroll from one end of the universe to another also betrayed an ignorance of the great difficulty of attaining a real truth. As the organism aged and youthful excitation diminished, the thinking individual entered a critical period that challenged him or her to find a mature, sustainable form to preserve youthful passion. For Pavlov, that form was systematized, specialized scientific studies, which replaced the direct authority of sensations with conscious, systematized behavior. Nature, then, opens the door and reveals the interesting and alluring kingdom of thought. But entrance was granted only to the person who undertakes serious and difficult work in order to make oneself worthy of it. Such religious illusions permeated Pavlov's letters. He was in part seeking to reassure a deeply religious woman that, despite his atheism, he was reliably moral. Yet he was also describing his own struggle to recast in secular form the religious certainties and values of his youth, and the central role of his science in doing so. His preoccupation with certainty emerged even in one love letter, where he wrote that, "My task is to help develop and to protect what exists in your mind and heart from various dangers and random events, случайности." His fiercely independent fiancée objected to this sentiment as patronizing, and it precipitated a quarrel. The materialism and scientism of the people of the 1860s would always remain embedded in Pavlov's outlook, but he had abandoned his earlier youthful attitude toward knowledge for the mature professionalism that he had imbibed from Sion. He now identified not as an 1860s materialist, but as a scientist, as he would later put it, a naturalist who investigates life by the method that best leads to the achievement of true knowledge. Yet he had also preserved his youthful passion for the big questions. The intellectual-emotional issues involved in his identification as a scientist and their relationship to his interest in the psyche also emerge in Pavlov's letter to Karchevskaya about Fyodor Dostoevsky, who was at this time intervening forcefully in the pressing ideological, political, and spiritual issues of the day. The young couple discussed the great writer's novels, The Adolescent, and especially The Brothers Karamazov. Karchevskaya was studying to become a teacher of rural peasants, and in 1880 helped arrange Dostoevsky's participation in a fundraiser for needy students, which led to several personal conversations with him that she cherished thereafter as the most important moment in my religious life. Our Dostoevsky, as Pavlov put it, became a point of reference as they grappled with their feelings and beliefs about a set of related important subjects for them as a couple, headed, perhaps, for marriage, faith and religion, reason and science, intimacy and morality. Reading The Brothers Karamazov, Pavlov identified uncomfortably with Ivan Karamazov, whose harsh rationality and inability to make a religious leap of faith condemned him to nihilism and spiritual disintegration. The more I read, the more uneasy my heart became. Karamazov's basic nature, or at least his given state, is the same as mine. Obviously, this is a man of the intellect. The mind alone has overthrown everything, reconstructed everything, and the person was left wooden-headed, with a terrible coldness in his heart, with the sensation of a strange emptiness in his being. Reason brought Karamazov rich satisfactions. Recall the great inquisitor and such great flights of moral thought. Yet what a sorry life he led. Pavlov described his own plight by citing Karamazov's confession that he would gladly surrender the pleasures of reason for the comforts of faith. Yet, like Karamazov, his nature and life experiences rendered this impossible. He rejected, though, Dostoevsky's view that this problem was rooted in the triumph of reason. It resided, rather, in our very nature, and so raised an important challenge beyond the reach of currently paltry science, understanding the human type. Pavlov returned constantly to this same theme. Liberal essayist Konstantin Kavelin had described the modern Mephistopheles as the devaluation of the emotional and subjective side of life in the face of recent successes in deterministic natural science. This, he reminded Karchevskaya, was his own inextricable issue. Yet here again he identified this as a problem with human nature, and so a challenge for science. How did one reconcile a law-governed universe with the special qualities of personal life, in which these laws are not in effect, where freedom necessarily rules? Science now offered only pathetic explanations, so man remained unable to understand the sense, the force of his personal aspirations and efforts. Human psychology remained one of the last secrets of life, the secret of the manner in which nature, developing by strict, unchangeable laws, came in the form of man to be conscious of itself. Returning to this same theme a few weeks later, he added, "Where is the science of human life? Not even a trace of it exists. It will, of course, but not soon. Not soon." He also addressed repeatedly Dostoevsky's view that reliable morality was impossible without religious faith. "I myself do not believe in God," he reminded Karchevskaya, but the religious language of his letters both captured his own struggle for secular replacements and reassured her that he shared her basic values and goals. Unshrinking rationality and a commitment to truth was the basis of his struggle for personal virtue, for moral dignity. "It is for me a kind of God, before whom I reveal everything, before whom I discard wretched worldly vanity." A commitment and disciplined approach to scientific truth could, he assured her, provide the same spiritual satisfaction and reliable moral compass as did religion. Physiological thinking. Pavlov's immersion in a medical milieu for 15 years contributed much to his developing scientific style. Deepening the sensibilities he had imbibed from Bernard and Sion, it encouraged his lifelong emphasis on whole animal physiology. Surrounded by clinics and practitioners at the country's center of scientific medicine, he constantly bore in mind the relationship of his research to medical practice and approached the experimental animal much as a physician approached a patient. Working on intact animals, he was, like a good physician, constantly aware of the differences between individuals, and, as he observed in one early article, the influence of an animal's psychic or physiological state on its responses to experiments. As manager of Botkin's lab, he was also compelled to develop management skills and think creatively about the organization of scientific work. Incorporation into Botkin's network generated a broad and influential circle of supporters for the young scientist, who, by his fierce loyalty to his exiled mentor, had alienated himself from the city's leading physiologists. The 2 years abroad, 1884 to 86, that he divided between Carl Ludwig's lab in Leipzig and Rudolf Heidenhain's in Breslau, also proved significant for his thinking about good physiology and a life in science. Pavlov found both scientists inspiring models of the mature mind, having preserved their childlike enthusiasm, energy, and kindness by placing their entire life, all its joy and grief, in science. Their scientific practices deepened the perspective Pavlov had imbibed from Sion. Ludwig emphasized precise measurement and the value of answering physiological questions in quantitative terms, and encouraged Pavlov's increasingly self-confident use of mechanistic imagery. Both Ludwig's isolated heart and Heidenhain's isolated stomach exemplified modern animal technologies that permitted experiments on an intact and functioning organ that responded more normally than during standard slash-and-stimulate vivisections. The differences between the two were equally instructive. Ludwig managed a new type of physiological lab that did not yet exist in Russia. A large, well-equipped facility that made efficient use of inexperienced scientists and physicians attracted by the growing prestige of scientific medicine. Appreciating the advantages of its scale, Pavlov was also critical of the distance it created between Ludwig and the lab bench, and of his experimental style. Experiments are generally conducted stingily. The small details of experiments are not especially taken into account. Instead, co-workers used more or less exact instruments to quantify experimental results, which Ludwig then subjected to careful, abstract processing in a study. Heidenhain operated a small workshop lab and practiced a scientific style that Pavlov considered much better for physiology, which required sensitive interpretation of messy data grounded in a grasp of the experimental situation as a whole. Constantly present at the bench and alert to every detail, Heidenhain conducted experiment after experiment each day, varying its particulars until he finally made himself the master of the fundamental condition. Only then did he record the results. The superiority of this approach was evident in Heidenhain's repeated correction of Ludwig's conclusions. "We are not physicists," Pavlov observed, "who can extract the numbers from an experiment and then leave in order to calculate the results in an office. The physiological experiment must always depend on a mass of the smallest circumstances and surprises, which must be noticed at the time of the experiment. Otherwise, our material loses its real sense." His wilderness years, then, prepared him well to take advantage of good fortune when, in 1890-91, another perfect storm suddenly transformed him from a struggling 40-year-old part-time lecturer to director of Russia's best-equipped and staffed physiological lab. The basic events were these. Botkin assigned Pavlov the apparently thankless task of representing him on the planning committee for a bacteriological institute under the aegis of activist philanthropist Prince Alexander Oldenburgsky. Hoping to publicize this project and win it state funding, Oldenburgsky pressed his scientific collaborators for a rapid experimental verification of Robert Koch's new cure for tuberculosis. The tactic backfired, despite hopeful initial signs. Tuberculin failed utterly, destroying Oldenburgsky's credibility within Russia's medical community. This forced the prince to broaden the scope of his institute and seek persons of lesser stature in order to recruit division chiefs. The prince finally prevailed on his cousin, Tsar Alexander III, to finance his new Imperial Institute of Experimental Medicine. After more eminent candidates either refused the posts or were disqualified as non-Russian, Oldenburgsky offered Pavlov, who had remained loyal throughout this ordeal and enjoyed the support of Botkin's network, the directorship, which Pavlov declined, and then the physiology division, which he accepted wholeheartedly. For Pavlov and his admiring wife, this extraordinary turn was not the result of slučajnost, but rather the long overdue fruit of his talents and achievements.